This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Did you know 19th century Americans were passionate about Shakespeare? At mid-century, two actors, two stars, dominated the stage. One, Edwin Forrest, was an American. The other, William Charles Macready, an Englishman. Once friends, they became enemies, and their feud helped spark rioting that in May 1849, resulted in the deaths in New York City of as many as 30 people. On the program today, we're going to talk about this fascinating but forgotten chapter of American history with Nigel Cliff. He is the author of The Shakespeare Riots, Revenge, Drama, and Death in 19th Century America. Cliff says the book is the story of how America struggled to find its own voice between two conflicting identities and how the contest ended in a bloody riot that shocked the whole nation and forced it to reconsider its most basic beliefs. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls this afternoon for our guest, Nigel Cliff. I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Nigel Cliff is a former theater and film critic for The Times of London and a contributor to The Economist. The Shakespeare Riots, Revenge, Drama, and Death in 19th Century America is his first book. The publisher is Random House. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Nigel Cliff, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. Glad to be with you.
The rioting that took place in New York in May of 1849 was not the first theater riot in the U.S. How common were such affairs, and what led to them?
They were pretty common, and they were on a huge scale. Amongst the biggest riots in the country, 5,000 people was a fairly typical number, and there was about one every two or three or four years throughout the 1820s, 30s, 40s. And most of them, I'm afraid to say, centered on English actors. There were a few involving local actors, but very, very few indeed, much smaller. And I think the reason is that English actors were very much the most prominent English people in America at the time. I mean, it was an era when politicians very rarely traveled between the two countries. And so when relations between the two countries were perhaps not at their best, an actor was a very easy target. He was the most public figure and the representative of his country.
How violent were these riots?
Well, the unique thing about the riot that is the centerpiece of my book is how bloody it became. Usually there was a lot of violence, but it was more a question of breaking down the theater doors, storming inside, throwing projectiles at the stage. People used to throw coins and shoes and fruit and rotten eggs, potatoes, at one point a turkey. In the most bizarre episode that my English actor was involved in, the raw carcass of half a sheep came thudding down onto the stage from the gallery up above. So it was more a question of really wrecking the building and stopping the performance and humiliating the actor and sending him home until the riot, which I describe, which really was the culmination of all of these years of antagonism, and was never repeated again. It was so shockingly violent that nobody dared do it again.
Yeah. As I mentioned, 19th century Americans passionate about Shakespeare, and you write in the book that main streets in America in the mid-19th century boasted Shakespeare saloons plastered with advertisements for Shakespeare almanacs and Shakespeare patent medicines. When and how and why had Shakespeare taken root in America?
I think it's hard to remember now how popular he was with very wide audiences. Everybody from the elite in the eastern cities, right down to deckhands on a Mississippi barge. These people used to go and see his plays sometimes weekly, sometimes even nightly. The theatre, of course, was the main, and in many places the only place to go to be entertained. And he was, people could recite his speeches off by heart. Sometimes they learned them at school, sometimes from a travelling elocutionist who roved around the country and taught people how to declaim. Rhetoric was incredibly popular at the time. People were glued to speeches in Congress between Daniel Webster, for instance, and his opponent over states' rights, something that covered acres of the newspaper and was reported with, you know, frenetic interest day after day. So Shakespeare really was on everybody's lips. And oftentimes you find that the actors knew the play less well than the audiences, even in very remote places. And the audience took absolute delight in prompting them and reminding them of their superior knowledge.
Yeah. One of the things that's fascinating in this story is the feeling of ownership Americans had toward the plays of Shakespeare.
Yes, it is. I think it's partly because a lot of the people in the country really still felt that they were part of English culture. But then there was another side which developed where a lot of Americans felt that they ought to have, that America ought to have its own national culture. And the one thing that was inescapable was Shakespeare. Alexis de Tocqueville, when he traveled around the country in the 1830s, said that he found a volume of Shakespeare in every wooden hut, every log cabin around the Midwest. It was very difficult to get away from him, and one of the ways to do it was to celebrate American actors performing Shakespeare, perhaps in a more, shall we say, democratic way, a more populist style, maybe something that we would see today as quite melodramatic and physical and heroic. So in a way, that was why this greater buckler started taking shape, because Shakespeare had to be done. It became that much more important to separate American Shakespeare from English Shakespeare.
Yeah. What about the stories, the themes of Shakespeare? That also played a role in how Americans felt about Shakespeare.
I'm sorry, the...
The stories, the themes of the plays.
Yes. I certainly think if you go back to the time when people were settling across the country and beginning new societies in this great experiment, founding whole new states, whole new ways of life, that they would look to the voice, the writer who was the voice of morality and of knowledge and of insight into the world, and they found something in there. I think they found a sense of a belief in humanity, certainly also a sense of being very aware of human frailties, A very sort of strong sense of good and evil and of the ways that societies worked or failed their citizens, which was something that people reflected on and spoke about and wrote about in the newspapers using Shakespeare's words every day.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the theater was the entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone went, and everyone was all thrown in together. That's very different than what we have today, isn't it?
It certainly is. I think that I wonder how we would feel if we went back to see these plays. I suppose it depends on your point of view. You probably couldn't have heard very much of them. That might have been a problem if you really liked your Shakespeare. These places were often frenetically noisy. You know, people in the boxes would be chattering away and sometimes having their dinner. And people in the pit downstairs would be shuffling in and out of the benches and going off to the bar. And all sorts of things went on up in the balcony. So we you know, perhaps wouldn't like to go back quite so far. But you do get the sense that we've lost something when one goes with such a respectful attitude, almost like, you know, a religious attitude towards these great works. We've lost that sense of it being something that people... just find, you know, that's in people's everyday lives, they find it the most natural thing to go and take it as part of the evening's entertainment, almost like watching television and turning your head away sometimes and doing something different for a while and then coming back to it when there's a big moment coming up.
And that changed with Astor Place.
Astor Place certainly had a role in changing it. I think it was changing anyway as the cities grew. And people started building new theaters which catered to certain classes of society. So in New York, down on the Bowery, you had a very huge burgeoning working-class theater scene. And then uptown, you started to have new theaters being built by the elite where they could rent out seats for the whole season and use them in a way as a drawing room outside of their home. But it's certainly true that the riot brought that to a climax, because after that, people were determined that they weren't going to sit in the same theater with others who were going to throw stuff at them and try to kill them, lob stones at them, and try and break up the theater. So it did have, I think, quite a ferocious effect in that way.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about your two main characters, the two actors, Edwin Forrest and William Charles McCready. Forrest, you say he was a poster child for Jacksonian America. Mm-hmm. What was his background?
He grew up in Philadelphia, the son of German immigrants who were fairly poor, and he got the acting bug at a very early age to his very religious Puritan mother's great distaste. And he ran away from home and took himself off to rural theaters in backwoods, where the ceiling would have holes in it, and people would put up umbrellas in the performance to keep themselves dry. And clearly, in that environment, things were fairly rudimentary, and someone wasn't going to be discovered as a great star. But he had a couple of lucky breaks. He was tracked down by a journalist who decided to adopt him, and at one point stopped him from running away to the circus. And put him on a steamboat to New Orleans. And he, first of all, became a star down in New Orleans. And then, after a few years there, a great triumph with people, mostly the dock workers down there, he had this wonderfully physical, heroic style with his glistening calves, which he oiled before every performance. After that, he decided to take on New York, and he moved up there suffered from a great panic attack and bout of depression and nearly ended it all, but again was rescued by someone who asked him to play a benefit for him when an actor was named as the star performer of that night and would get most of the earnings of the play, and he was an extraordinary success. People really felt that they'd discovered the first great American actor, and he was still only 21 years old. And within a year, he was earning something like, it depends how you translate it, but at least $4,000 or $5,000 a performance. Or $5,000 a performance, which was unheard of at the time. And he never turned back.
Yeah. What was he like off the stage?
He was perhaps quite a difficult man. He had very serious friends. Accountants and lawyers, middle-class, respectable business people. He didn't like entertaining very much. He'd grown up his father died very young. He'd grown up with three Puritan sisters and a Puritan mother, and the three sisters never married. So he had a very hard-working and dutiful attitude towards life. Rather a different reputation than he's been given before. Some people associated him with all the gangs who became his great fans and thought that he, was himself running around wreaking havoc the whole time. He did have an extraordinarily bad temper, which got him into all sorts of scrapes and, in the end, led him to become very bitter and suspicious of the English actor who became his rival.
Hmm. Tell us about the gangs and why they took a shine to him.
Well, if you think of the period in we're really in the 1830s and 40s, which is, I suppose, about 20 years before the Gangs of New York film. And down in the Bowery, in the working-class entertainment district of New York, the gangs ran the scene. They used to go together in huge groups to the theater, particularly the Bowery Theater, which seated 3,000 or 4,000 people. And they would sit there in the rows, eating their chops and throwing the bones at the stage when they'd finished and shouting at their friends. And and Edwin Forrest became their great hero. He was the hero they were looking for, the real thing, the big, strapping, self-confident, young, handsome, giant from the backwoods. Mm-hmm. And they adopted him as their mascot for many years.
It's reminiscent of the stories that we have today about our soccer players or football players, isn't it?
It really is. And I think people who if you were to see some of the more rambunctious scenes at some of these theaters, it would remind you very strongly of crowd scenes at a pretty fiercely contested soccer match, yeah.
Yeah. What kinds of things did critics say about Forrest?
Well, he had, I think, an extraordinarily supportive press on the whole, because everybody was so excited to have a homegrown star for the first time. And people said, you know, let us support this tender sapling and show to the old world that we can outdo them in talent on stage as well as in politics. And they really saw him as a national mascot. He was enormously supported. And when he went into towns around the country when he was on tour, the newspapers would signal his arrival with great puff pieces celebrating his progress around the country, almost in a regal fashion. There were some newspapers who were a bit sniffy about him, some of the more upmarket New York papers. But even those, on the whole, until the riot happened, and rather put paid to that, even they were whipped up in this fervor of supporting the first great American star.
Hmm. Did he perform Shakespeare solely, or were there other works that he would play?
He did perform other works. I would say he performed Shakespeare about half of the time. In fact, Shakespeare accounted for fully a quarter of all performances in America in the 19th century, an extraordinary figure, I think.
Mm.
But when he was very young, launched a playwriting competition, which gave him even more kudos with his rather patriotic friend, to discover new American plays. And he came up with a few. There's one called Metamora, the Last of the Wanapoags, which was about an Indian chieftain, and a play about Jack Cade, the English rebel, I think 13th century revolutionary. And they were huge barnstorming successes, and there's some figure like about 1.5 million people saw him just in those plays. But Shakespeare was really the great test for the leading actors of the time.
Mm. Nigel Cliff is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of The Shakespeare Riots, Revenge, Drama, and Death in 19th Century America. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Join the conversation with a call to either 333-9455, that's 333-WILL, or toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Across the Atlantic at this time, it's interesting that to realize that the bard was not so fashionable. Why?
His popularity had slipped. You have to, I think, first think that what was being done on stage until my English actor did something about it was often very remote from what we know of as Shakespeare. A lot of the plays had been rewritten and turned into much more melodramatic entertainments with, you know, flying witches and all sorts of trapeze acts going on, and much worse than that. So he had been always something of a mainstream taste, certainly not an elite taste. And that process really gathered momentum in the 1830s, when the two great theatres, Drury Lane and Covent Garden, which were the only two theatres where legally Shakespeare was allowed to be performed, great barns of places, 5,000 seats in each at one point, they fell on hard times, and they started importing lots of pantomimes and things like that, and they got rather fed up with having to do Shakespeare and really tried to get away with it as little as possible. And in England, the separation, I think, of classes in the theatre occurred a little earlier. So so that the upper classes were going off to the opera, where the Queen sat every night, and the theatres were rather abandoned to mainstream popular entertainment.
Yeah, well, then enter William Charles MacCready.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about his background and family. He was born in 1793.
He was, and his father was an Irish actor who performed at Covent Garden in a very minor part and decided that it would be much more self-important to become a theatre manager in the regions, in the provinces. And so he had two or three theatres which he ran. And like every other actor at the time, he was absolutely desperate that his children would not go anywhere near the stage, which was, of course, you know, rather a disreputable profession at the time. So he sent him off to public school, where he was trained to be a lawyer or perhaps a priest. Then the family went bankrupt, and his father got put in jail. And MacCready, at the age of 16, had to leave school, start learning all his parts, and go on the boards in order to save the family fortune.
Yeah.
So he always had a very ambivalent and somewhat disdainful attitude towards the profession, which he became very much the leader of in this country.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You write that he hated the business of it.
He couldn't stand it. I mean, he couldn't stand actors. He couldn't stand all the drunkenness and all of the sort of, you know, whiff of vice that surrounded the theatres, which were usually situated in the rougher parts of town. You weren't allowed to be called a gentleman at the time if you were an actor, and he was brought up to be a gentleman. And I think he found it a disgrace to his own sense of self throughout his life. He wrote the most extraordinary diaries, which thankfully have survived, which are full of self-loathing for the profession that he was an extraordinarily powerful force in changing for the better.
Oh. When did he become a star?
He became a star just a few years after he had left school to support his father's companies. He had a giant row with his father and stormed out. Both of these actors had huge tempers. And he marched off to London and decided to risk it all on appearing at one of the big national theatres. And he wasn't quite such an early success, immediate success as Forrest. He had to work his way up. It was an extraordinarily competitive scene with really only two star roles for tragic actors in the city, with these two theatres that were allowed to perform Shakespeare. It was incredibly full of backstabbing and bitchiness,
mm-hmm.
and all sorts of horrors. So it took him quite a long time to fend off his rivals. And whereas Forrest had such a supportive press, a lot of the there was so much factionalism in London that a lot of the newspapers puffed up one actor who they decided to adopt and spent half their time trying to destroy the reputation of the other one.
Mm.
You know, there's nothing in celebrity rags that wasn't around at that time.
Yeah, an old story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Were there theatre riots in Britain?
There were. There was a very famous riot in the early 19th century, which went on for, I think it was 83 days. And it was all over something rather petty, as often these things were. It was because one of the two big theatres had been rebuilt, and they'd pushed up their prices to try and cover their costs. And at the same time, they'd hired a foreign-born singer, which was terribly scandalous to appear there. And so the audience howled the first performance off the stage, and they kept on doing it for weeks and weeks afterwards. They made themselves medals, and they printed T-shirts and caps, and I don't think they had T-shirts then, but the equivalent of those. And jackets and they with the insignia, which they, I mean, it was one of the first branding exercises that signaled their descent. And they would stand on the benches in the performance and turn their backs on the stage. Sometimes they would do a jig, a little dance on the benches. Sometimes they put them to one side and they staged little mock fights in the auditorium. They would pelt the actors every time they came on. And it went on in this completely farcical way for about 3 months.
Wow.
Maybe 3 months.
Wow.
At MacReady, unfortunately, had turned up in London. This was when he had decided to make himself into an actor. He turned up in London as a young man to see what he could learn about the profession. And the first night he went to the theatre, this is what confronted him.
Oh, I feel for this guy, you know?
Yeah. You know,
he's a very sympathetic character, isn't he?
He's a difficult man who was very torn up, but I think you do feel for him because he was so determined to throw himself into doing everything he could to raise his profession up at the same time as finding it a struggle even to go on every stage and feel that he was doing something that was right in his life. I think in some ways he was a much gentler and sweeter and better-natured character than he's been portrayed, and that sometimes he let himself be, sometimes he burst out with this fierce temper just because he was so, I think, taken to the edge of his wits by all of the mayhem that surrounded him every night.
Mm. Let's take a telephone call now from a listener in Terre Haute on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Could you tell us, please, that some of the primary roles in Shakespeare's plays were that MacReady and Forrest both either were known for?
I couldn't hear the question.
Yeah,
I
think I'll take a shot at it. And listeners, stay on the line with us here, and we'll see if we can sort this out. She wants to know what roles, what plays, the two actors were most famous for.
Mm-hmm.
That's Shakespeare.
In Shakespeare.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
They pretty much ran through all of the tragedies. They didn't do many of the comedies because you really specialized at that time. It was very unusual to cross over, although they did do a few. Macbeth was MacReady's favorite role. One critic at one point said when he crept into the king's chamber to murder him, he looked like a thief going to snatch a woman's purse. Really didn't have the heroic nature to do it. And many people thought that he was greatest at Hamlet, where his somewhat diffident and frustrated, awkward character, I think, really found the role for him. But they played the whole range. Forrest, I think, was particularly good in Othello. He seemed to have the sort of the majesty and the strength and the will to play that character very powerfully.
I want to thank the listener for her question this afternoon. Other telephone calls are invited. Our guest this afternoon, Nigel Cliff, author of The Shakespeare Riots, Revenge, Drama, and Death in 19th Century America. The phone number is 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, what was the situation? Talk with us about what the situation was in terms of relations between England and America, mm-hmm. between the two countries and their people, because this also added fuel to what would become the Shakespeare riot of May 1849.
It certainly did. I mean, we talk over here about the special relationship between the two countries, but it was special in a rather different way then. You know, of course, the War of 1812 is what a lot of people remember. But what I didn't know until I started researching this book is that in the 1830s, and particularly the 1840s, we were nearly going to war all the time. There was the question of the Oregon Territory, which was still disputed between the two countries, and also the border with Maine. There was the question of Mexico and America invading Mexico. There was the question of Texas, which Britain wanted to be independent to counterbalance the United States' strength. Very nearly we came to war several times. There was also a cultural edge to the disagreement, and I think that perhaps because the political argument had been to some extent settled in the War of Independence, the cultural question came to the fore. People wanted to separate themselves in terms of an identity, a cultural identity from the old country. There was a real sense of outrage in America about some of the stuff that British writers used to come over and write, particularly Charles Dickens, who was the most famous, but several other writers as well, who would turn up in America, be very well received, go back home, and write extremely nasty, fierce books, denigrating the country and the people's manners and the way that they ate dinner fast without talking. And one of the most famous was called The Domestic Manners of the Americans by someone called Fanny Trollope, the novelist Anthony Trollope's mother, which caused an absolute storm of outrage, absolute fierce denunciations all over the place. People used to chant her name in the street and burn her in effigy and print songs, rather smutty songs based on her name, denigrating her. And so there was a real popular sense of grievance as well as a political struggle going on.
In light of that, it's interesting, isn't it, that any English actor could work on the American stage, and any American actor could have worked on the English stage.
It really is, and of course, in the end, as we know, it ended in tragedy. But it's extraordinary how many English actors were traipsing around America, and you know, in a time when it was extremely tough traveling to get through the country, they popped up all over the place in Kentucky and down the Mississippi. All across the country, in Florida, before it was even a state, when the Seminole War was going on, and so you do get a sense that America perhaps hadn't had time to establish its own theater traditions, and that at the beginning, entertainment was really an English monopoly. People would find London too crowded as a profession for actors. And they would get on the boat, they'd emigrate or come for a tour of a couple of years and make quite a lot of money traveling around America.
Yeah. What were MacReady's expectations for America, and what was his experience?
MacReady, rather ironically, was a great Democrat and a great Republican and couldn't bear the English establishment, partly perhaps because they wouldn't let him be part of it. And he had a great affection for America. He used to talk it up incessantly when he went home, and his diaries are full of praise of the country. He used to celebrate the 4th of July every year by giving a prayer of thanks to America as the example for the future of the world. Of course, none of this really mattered because, in the end, he was the most famous Englishman in America at the time, and he became a target regardless of his more personally held political views.
Hmm. It's interesting to note that Dickens and MacReady were friends.
They were great friends, perhaps even best friends. MacReady was certainly one of Dickens's very, very small number of very close confidants.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that in the 19th century, at this point, Americans are passionate about Shakespeare, and even though Dickens wound up hating America, we have embraced him and his novels.
All was forgiven in the 1860s when he came on another tour and decided he'd been wrong. But I think he was by far the most famous Englishman who had ever appeared in America when he went on a tour of the country to write a travel book. And he was carried on people's shoulders everywhere. Balls were thrown in his honor. Delegations would travel 1,000 miles across the country to invite him to their town. And he was treated like a conquering hero. And I think, you know, he was, even at a young age, even in his 30s, he was seen as the great entertainer. And it was very hard to turn away from him. So I think there was a lot of bitterness in America about his view of the country because he was so loved. And it did take some time, I think, before his reputation recovered there, but it eventually did.
Yeah. I don't know how much of the story we want to tell, or for that matter, how much time we have left here. But I think we should get to the heart of the issue. We have these two very different fellows, although they had quite a number of similarities. But in the end, there was an incident, and this puny, trifling thing, very sad, it contributed to the explosion that lay ahead in New York City. A tiny spark, this tiny incident, falls onto what I would call a stack of very flammable materials.
Mm-hmm.
And not unlike oil-soaked rags, class and country, and boom.
Absolutely. It's the most extraordinary chain of events that somehow created the conditions for this great loss of life and this riotous disturbance that brought New York to a halt for several days. It's a peculiar story, and I think that one of the fun things about it is that it takes you through so many different parts of life then, and you see them all connecting together and leading to this point. The original point at which the feud between these two actors became public, because at the beginning they were friends, and it is, I think, sad that that they lost faith in each other and became such fierce enemies, when in some ways they were very similar people. The point at which the feud became public was over one line of Hamlet, where Edwin Forrest disagreed rather violently with Macready's interpretation, and stood up in the theater and hissed his disapproval very loudly, which was quite a scandalous thing for an actor to do to a fellow actor, particularly the leading star of one country to the leading star of another. And it all unraveled from there on.
Yeah. And Macready in this country was embraced by the elite, and Forrest was the man of the hoi polloi.
Exactly. So as well as being an international rivalry, it also became something of a class issue in New York. There was a great love for England among the elite, I think, in the city, or many of the members of the elite. There were a lot of Anglophiles who liked their culture to be highbrow and English, and Macready was the great representative of that style. He was the serious intellectual actor who was raising the profession of the theatre to respectability. So it was when the upper classes built themselves a swanky new theatre where Macready was invited to perform, that this got up the noses of the gangs and the people who felt that that America was in danger of perhaps following England too far and becoming too influenced by aristocratic ideas again.
Mm. So culture war is nothing new either.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, one sort of thinks about the way that English actors are taken in America today. You know, you still have little feuds going on Broadway when a musical comes over and the English cast tries to come over with it. There's some resentment of that. You think of actors getting Oscars. Loads of English actors always wiping the Oscars. We had Helen Mirren this year and the Queen. And yet they often seem to be playing the villains. So I don't think a great deal has changed over the last 150 years.
Hmm. How did this episode of history affect the theater in America?
The main effect of it was to make the theater polarized, to push respectable theaters to ban alcohol, to weed out the undesirable elements in the audience, to advertise fountains of iced water instead of bars, and I think it really led to a much tamer version of the traditional type of theatre. On the other hand, it led to the creation of, or it speeded up the creation of vaudeville theatres and variety houses. Further downtown, which became great rambunctious musicals full of drinking and songs and little skits, which originally would have been part of the entertainment at the main theaters each night.
Yeah. And the movies, when they came along then, Americans were ready to embrace that, those that were not of the elite.
Yes. I think that the movies certainly led on from the variety hall side of end of entertainment, particularly at the beginning. And the acting style, if you think of someone like, John Barrymore, for instance, seems perhaps a little bit more hammy, but seems to come very much from that tradition that Edwin Forrest established as the great, heroic, manly, physical actor.
Yeah. And there's more in the way of variety in terms of the entertainments that Americans have. More people are able to put their hands on the novels, say, of Charles Dickens or Mark Twain.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it certainly exploded in that way that there's so many different forms of entertainment on offer, and not just the one place where you go and everybody meets there every night to take what's on offer. But I suppose you lose that sense of collusion, of cohesion, of everybody speaking the next morning about the play they saw the night before. You lose that the coziness that you used to have in those old theaters.
Mm. And Shakespeare fades away and is now seen as more of a theater experience for the elite.
Yes, I think that's true. The Shakespearean actors followed him, followed the audiences who had the money, and so it became a very respectful audience. He really died away. There were some skits of his plays performed in the variety vaudeville houses for quite some years, because people still knew their Shakespeare off by heart. But as the mainstream nightly presentation of his plays started to dwindle away, people forgot about him.
Mm.
And by the end of the century, it was really quite hard to find Shakespeare in certainly in the major regional centres, where travelling actors would go from Broadway. There was a cartel at the Syndicate, which took over Broadway, and it shipped productions all over the country. And it found it rather tiresome to do Shakespeare, because you needed a lot of people and a lot of scenery, and it was much easier to do a small play with a couple of people in a drawing room. So for various reasons, he started to fade away.
Mm. Alas, poor Shakespeare. How did you come across this story?
I was a theatre critic for several years, as mm-hmm. you said, and I'd never heard of it. I knew actually very, very little about the two actors as well. And I was researching something else, and I really just started, I came across it in a book, and I started reading. And then I got fascinated by the idea that you would have miners sitting around campfires in the Gold Rush in California,
yeah.
reciting off chunks of the play. And I thought, my goodness, what is this? And the combination of this extraordinary riot and this absolute craze for Shakespeare. Emerson at one point said that he thought that if there were people watching Earth from other planets, they probably called the planet Shakespeare.
Oh.
It was quite the most extraordinary craze.
Oh. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. It's a wonderful story, and it is a very good read.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for talking with us this
Pleasure.
Afternoon. Nigel Cliff has been our guest in this portion of the program. He is the author of The Shakespeare Riots, Revenge, Drama, and Death in 19th Century America. This is his first book, the publisher, Random House.